At this point, I welcome you to take out your Bibles and turn to Matthew chapter 2. We're in a series right now going through the miracles that happened surrounding Christ's birth, of his coming to us. And these miracles that God did during that time highlight that he was up to something big, something world-changing. They point us to Jesus to see who he is and what he has done for us. And we started the first week looking at how God gave John the Baptist to Elizabeth and to Zechariah in their old age, barren, starting over in their late years of their life. What a miracle that was, and how that pointed to Jesus. And then the next one we looked at last week was how on the opposite end of the spectrum, God gave a child to a young virgin named Mary, and Jesus himself was born through her. But God put the embryo in her womb. And Jesus, we talked about the significance of how he's fully God and yet also fully man. This week, we're going to look at the miracle of what happened as God sent the Magi to come and to worship the newborn king, Christ. Now, the Magi came from 800 miles away. It's a pretty amazing story, whereas we're going to look at it here today. And I have lots of questions surrounding, like, how would this happen? Like how would they know to come? If they're 800 miles away, how do they ever get word? Like, and how do they interpret that star to know that something significant was happening there? And so we're going to wrestle with those this morning. There's a lot of maybe even gaps in our information about who these guys are. In fact, you may have been singing the song this week, "We Three Kings of Orient." I don't know, did anyone sing that yet in December? Okay, a few people. Others might have heard it on a radio or something like that. This morning when I sang that out loud for the first service, I said that was the first time I've sung that all this year here in December. So you're welcome. You got the second rendition right there. Christmas cards, you see the wise men coming. Manger scenes, you see the wise men there with the shepherds. I just want to tell you, I'm sorry to burst your bubble, that's wrong. They weren't there at the same time as the shepherds. So I want to quiz you on what do we know about the wise men? So the first question, this is a little bit of audience participation, Q&A. First question, go ahead and put it up here for us on the screen. If you're on live stream, sorry, I'll try to talk it out because you probably can't see these questions. How many wise men were there? 3, 12, or we don't know?
We don't know.
I hear a lot of people saying C. All right, so the tradition in our area and in this western part of the world is to think 3. Eastern Christianity, like Eastern Orthodox, often thinks 12. So who's right and who's wrong? Yeah, all right. The Bible doesn't say. It doesn't tell us how many. So the correct answer is C. If you called out letter C, put up your hand so we can know that you're right. Okay, good job. All right, put your hands down. Let's see how you do in the next question. Here we go. The visitors from the east were what? Kings or magi or astronomers or scholars? Let's start hearing the answers.
C.
C. A. B. All of the above is not one of the answers. That's lots of murmuring. I like this. All right. So the answer is they were anything but kings. They were not kings. So the song "We Three Kings" is incorrect, and I'll clear that up here in just a few moments. But Magi is actually the biblical word that is used of them in Matthew chapter 2, and so we'll dig into that. But they were also astronomers. They studied stars and formations and all that. They did more than that. They tried to interpret the stars. So they were also astrologers. That's the difference between astronomers and astrologers. They were scholars, leading scholars who studied mathematics and science and history and all those kinds of things as well. All right, next question. When did they arrive to worship Jesus? Christmas Day, several weeks later, at least a year later, or we don't know. What? At least a year. I heard for C. B, several weeks later. All of the above. That is not an answer. And it doesn't even make sense on this one. We're kicking you out of here. All right. Okay, if you were listening to me a few moments ago, you know that Christmas Day is incorrect. It could not be possibly letter A, which is Christmas Day. So if you're voting for B, raise your hand. If you're voting for C, raise your hand. If you're voting for D, raise your hand. Letter D, you're catching on. We don't know. The Bible does not say exactly. Now, if you voted for C, I'll probably, you know, say you're probably the most accurate guess, but technically we don't know. The only clue that we have in the text is that Jesus, after he was born, the wise men came, and then King Herod wanted to know where he was, so he said, hey, tell me where they are, and then they left, but then King Herod decided to kill all the baby boys 2 years and under. So it was at least under that time frame, but it could have been months, it could have been over a year after Jesus was born that they came. All right, last question. What were their names? All the above. Knuckleheads down here in the front. Yeah. What were their names? Anybody voting for B? Larry, Moe, and Curly. Three Stooges, no. How about Nick, Joe, and Kevin? Who knows what that even is? Jonas, I had to Google to find out who the Jonas Brothers' names were because I didn't know, but I put that in there for the younger audience. You know, we got an older audience and we got a younger audience going right there, B and C. Anyone voting for A? Balthazar, Melchior, and Casper. Actually, if you're catching on, there's a pattern here. We don't know. We don't know their names. There's a tradition of letter A, but that's just totally made up, so... we're going with the fact that we don't know. There's a lot of things we don't know about this story, but there are some things we do know. Matthew chapter 2, starting in verse 1. We'll just read the first two verses to start with here. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews?" Now just catch real quick with me that they knew the question to ask as they came. They already knew there was a king to be born of the Jews. "We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." So the Magi mentioned in here is a real group of people in history. It's a tribe of people actually that lived in what we know as at that time was the Parthian Empire. We're going to go ahead and put a map on the screen. And this is of modern day Iran and Iraq. And so anything you see in green there is the area of the Parthian Empire. And it is to the east of Jerusalem. Everything of where Israel is and out to the west was ruled by who at the time when Jesus was born? The Romans. And there was a clash happening right where the two empires met. Now, can you see any reason why Herod, who was appointed by the Romans, would be nervous if there was a king of the Jews that was born? Can you see a recipe of conflict going on here? The Parthian guys are coming out there saying, "Hey, there's a new king in Jerusalem," and Herod's going, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, there's no other kings here but me, and then, of course, Caesar, who's in Rome. So there can't be a new king here," and that's why Herod wants to stomp out any rumor of that or any existence of some king that's been born. And so he was deeply threatened by the Magi who came. But the Magi were from the capital city would have been where Babylon is, between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And you can see the red arrow that shows a line from Babylon to Jerusalem. And that is 800 miles. 800 miles through a whole lot of desert, dry conditions, and through some mountains as well. That would be like us traveling from here down to Jacksonville, Florida. Sounds pretty good right about now, doesn't it? Go down to Jacksonville. But imagine before there were trains, before there were airplanes, before there were cars, traveling 800 miles. It was an incredible journey these guys made to get to Jerusalem. Now, historically, these guys dated way, way back. Like, there's actually some records that would put them as far as Abraham's time, 2,000 years before Christ. But we really start to see the Magi come into power in the 800s, 700s before Christ, during the Assyrian Empire. You might recognize them as the ones who took over the northern kingdom of Israel. During the Babylonian Empire, who are the ones who took over the southern kingdom of Israel. During the Medo-Persian Empire, and now in the Parthian Empire. The Magi were the ones who held the power power in those empires. Why? Because, first of all, they held the spiritual card. They were the ones who were able to, at least claim to, be able to get guidance from the supernatural. They practiced divination. What is divination? It's the manipulation or seeking of favor of powers to be able to find things like guidance and provision and to be able to even get your way with them. They have certain kinds of practices like astrology and sacrifices and things like that in order to contact spiritual powers. Now, their influence still exists in our world today. If you drive down Trindle Road, you'll see a picture of Mrs. Natalie's astrology horoscope readings. This is the kind of thing that the Magi did, except with great respect and with great power and influence. Here at Miss Natalie's, you can get your palm read, you can have tarot cards, you can have astrology, clairvoyance, and charka readings, and many other things that their website says. The Bible tells us to have nothing to do with these kinds of things. We just make that very clear. This is of the enemy, of the devil himself. That's who the Magi were. They held the spiritual card in their culture. They also held the education card. As I said earlier, they were ones who studied mathematics and agriculture and architecture and all kinds of science, astronomy, and the astrology. That's the combining of the science and the religion. These guys were the ones that everyone consulted, especially kings. They wanted to know an answer about what they should do. Well, they would contact the spiritual advisors, the Magi. And if it was coming time to choose a new king, guess who they consulted? The Magi. And guess who? What every king had to be schooled in was the teaching of the Magi. And so they were choosing governors, they were choosing judges, they were choosing kings. They had a kind of power and influence in these empires that was greatly revered. People sought after them. They became very wealthy. And these are the ones, these spiritually wayward kinds of guys that God chose to send to Jerusalem, then to Bethlehem, to worship Jesus Christ. It's kind of a mind-blowing thing. Let's get into why. Like, what is all this about? Well, Matthew chapter 2 was not the first time that we encounter these guys in the Bible. We actually see the Magi in the book of Daniel. This is 550 years before Christ was born. If you remember, during the Babylonian Empire, they came and they conquered Jerusalem and the southern kingdom of Israel, and they killed most of the people and took away the ones that they wanted to enlist into the king's service. And Daniel was young. He was of royal descent. He was spiritual. So they brought him off and a bunch of his friends, and they tried to indoctrinate them into the teachings of the Babylonian Empire. If you remember from Daniel chapter 1, Daniel resisted. He said, I want to stay true to the one living God. I'm not going to eat the food that you give me. I'm not going to have my brain washed by the things that you're telling me. But he applied himself and he learned. And he actually, it says at the end of chapter 1, became 10 times wiser than all of the other magicians and astrologers and sorcerers and enchanters of the kingdom. 10 times wiser he was found to be. In Daniel chapter 2, a problem happens in the kingdom. King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and he's greatly troubled and disturbed by this dream. And so he says, I want to call together all of my spiritual advisors, and I want them to tell me what the dream was and then interpret it for me. And they said, this is an impossible task. How can we know what your dream was? He's like, well, if you can tell me the dream, then I'll know that your interpretation is real. And so he gives them time, and they're all trying to do their spiritual powers to try to find out what this dream was, and nobody can find it out. And for whatever reason, Daniel was not consulted in this, but he hears about it going on. And he says, wait, give me some time, me and my friends. And so they take an all-night prayer meeting, and God reveals the dream to Daniel. And he reveals the interpretation to Daniel. And he tells it to the king. And guess what the king does? He says, your God revealed this to you. He is the supreme one God. And he elevates Daniel over top of all of the enchanters, astrologers, sorcerers, magicians in the empire. That's speaking of the Magi. Daniel gets put in charge of them. Imagine that, a guy who is true to Yahweh, the one true God, a guy who's faithful to all of his laws and teaching, gets put in charge of the Magi. Huh. Time goes on and power changes hands a couple of times. Eventually it ends up in the hands of the Medo-Persian Empire. Daniel's still there. And somehow, in the course of time, you can read the story in the book of Daniel, Daniel gets elevated to be one of the three top guys in all the kingdom under King Darius. If you remember, he was very successful. What he did is he was managing, and the other satraps, they call them, these other rulers, got jealous of Daniel and wanted to find a way to kill him. So they set up a trap for it all because Daniel prayed every day. And they got Daniel to be sentenced to death in a lion's den. And so King Darius is distraught when he finds this out, and he says, well, we got to go through with it. It's law. And so Daniel gets thrown in the lion's den, and God protects Daniel. You remember the story? Daniel comes out. He's untouched, and King Darius proclaims that Daniel's God is the one true God, the supreme God. And there's all this revering and respecting of Yahweh. And Daniel continues to live on. Now, throughout this time, Daniel was a prophet. He was receiving words from the Lord and dreams and visions. And they're all recorded in the book of Daniel. Let me ask you a question. Do you think that Daniel had a place of influence to be able to instruct the Magi and teach them things about Yahweh? Do you think that he was able to reveal things of the prophecies that he had received to them? Do you think he told them prophecies that were already into the Old Testament scriptures at that time? Somehow, somewhere, things were probably written down in the records of the kingdom, and there were certain people that probably latched onto that and saw it, caught onto it. Let me put on an example on the screen. This is Daniel chapter 9, verse 25. It says this, "Know and understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem," which happened several years later under King Cyrus, "until the anointed one," which is this, another word for Messiah, the promised king, "the ruler comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens." Daniel received this prophecy during the time that he had influence while he was still alive there in Babylon. What are the seven sevens? Well, it refers to years. So you have 49 years and then 62 sevens, which is like 400 and I can't remember. You add them together and it's 483 years, which gives you a time frame of from when the time of this prophecy where then King Cyrus would declare that they could go back and rebuild Jerusalem until the time that the Messiah would come, whether it's his birth or whether it's when he started his ministry. There's some debate about that because you don't know if the way that we calculate years is exactly the same the way that they calculated years and all that. But anyways, it puts you right into the time frame of Christ's life. Is it possible that the Magi knew of that and were watching for a king to be born in Jerusalem? Look at another prophecy from Numbers chapter 24. It says, "I see him now, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near." It's kind of far off. "A star will rise out of Jacob," metaphorically speaking, but maybe also literally speaking, that a new king would come out of Israel, out of Jacob. "A scepter will rise out of Israel." The Magi may have known to be watching for a star. They definitely heard of a king who would be born in Jerusalem. Watching, waiting for the day when this would happen. It's not too far out of our imaginations to think that that's what happened. That they had this knowledge. Somehow or another, they knew to come to Jerusalem. They knew to ask for the king of the Jews. And it was coordinated by the same God who had the Israelites exiled out of Israel into Babylon. The same God who raised up Daniel into power. The same God who was given these prophecies. The same God who lined all this up so the Magi could be watching and waiting for the Messiah to be born to worship him. Now, I believe the Magi were spiritually misguided. They were actually into things that were against the Lord. I'm sure they kept practicing those things, but there was something of an element wanting to seek the truth, knowing these prophecies, wanting to see this one who was born. They were God seekers in that sense. And God sent them, arranged all of this hundreds of years before Christ was born. He was 100 steps ahead on a chess game in the world, making this all happen so that they would show up at just the right time in Jerusalem. That's how big our God is. That's how amazing he is. Let's pick up again in verse 3. When King Herod heard this, that they were there asking about a king, he was disturbed, yeah. Ticked off, deeply troubled, concerned, threatened, fill in the blank. And all Israel with him, or all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ, the Messiah, was to be born. And these guys knew the answer, what the prophecy said. They said, in Bethlehem in Judea. For this is what the prophet has written. This is from Micah 5, chapter 2. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people, Israel. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report him to me so that I too may go and worship him. Yeah, right. We're going to pause there for a moment. So the Magi showed up in Jerusalem asking about this new king that had been born. Now, we don't know if it was 3 Magi, 12 Magi, 20 Magi. We have no idea how many came. But if a bunch of wealthy people are traveling 800 miles through a desert, and they are kingmakers and influencers from their home country, are they going to come just them, like one-on-one on a camel? No. In fact, people assume there might be up to 100 people that came in a caravan across the desert like that. Because you would need not only the Magi, you would need, they have expensive gifts with them, so you need animals to carry those gifts. You would need security with you to protect this caravan from robbers and thieves. You would need animals. You would need animal caretakers. You would need food and water. You would need guides. You would need everything that comes with months on the road together through a desert. This was a big entourage showing up in Jerusalem. Oh yeah, and by the way, would they have been riding camels, or would they have been riding what wealthy Persian people would ride, which would be horses, maybe even like white horses, coming into the city? Would they stand out? Would they be noticeable? Absolutely. Everyone's going, who are these guys? What are they doing here? They're from the Orient. They're from the East. They're from the Parthian Empire. What are they showing up here for? And then to hear that they're asking about where this king was born. Now, what I find ironic is that nobody in Jerusalem has a clue that Christ was born. These are the Jewish chief priests. They're the ones who should know all of the spiritual happenings of their own country. They should be on the top of what's going on with prophecies and all that's happening. They don't have any clue. King Herod, who's been put there by the Jews or by the Romans, has no idea that another king was born, presumably months earlier than when the Magi showed up. Let me ask you, how far is it from Jerusalem where they live to Bethlehem where Jesus was born? 5.5 miles. It's like going from here to the Capital City Mall. And they had no idea that Jesus was born. The irony that's in here, yet guys who are 800 miles away know exactly where he is. That's crazy. God sent the Magi there to seek out Christ. Now the chief priests and the religious rulers knew the prophecy that he was still to be born in Bethlehem, so they have that piece of information right. But none of them had gone down there and checked it out. None of them had gone down there to worship the king. And even when the Magi showed up, they still didn't go down to try to find out. Herod just says to the Magi, hey, tell me, you know, come back, tell me where he is because I'm going to worship him. We know that he has in mind to kill him as a threat. Well, let's pick up what happened next. Verse 9, after they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. And on coming to the house, let me just linger on that word for a second, not stable, not barn. They had been there. They were settled for a while in Bethlehem. In fact, you wonder, why did they not go back to Nazareth up in the north where they came from in the first place? But they were hanging out in Bethlehem for now. They were going to have to flee to Egypt soon. When the wise men came to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. The wise men, they get to Jesus in Bethlehem. What was the miracle that got them there? A star. We haven't talked about the star yet. What is a star? Just blurt it out. Yeah. Usually billions of miles, millions of miles away. Fiery ball of inferno. Really hot, burning up in the sky. Normally they don't just move around, right? They're kind of stationary. But somehow this star seems to rise. And then it seems to disappear because when they get to Jerusalem, they don't know where to go. And so they have to ask where to go and get directions. And then as soon as they start going to Bethlehem, all of a sudden the star shows up again. If there's a distance from here to the Capital City Mall, do you think a star would be moving and somehow lead you to that direction and then stop over top of a house? Like, what kind of star are we talking about? Is this something that is truly millions of miles away? Is this something that's just a few thousand feet above the earth and so it's able to kind of move? Is it a star? Is it the glory of God? Is it an angel? We don't know the answer to all that. It's just a miraculous fire in the sky that leads them directly to where Jesus was. It's incredible. It's truly a miracle that God was leading them directly to where the child was. He was communicating with them. And what was their reaction? When they're finally, after all these months of planning and packing and studying, and they get to Jerusalem and they make the trip across the desert, they get directions, they see the star and it's leading them directly where they need to be. What's their reaction? All this anticipation. Verse 11. They were overjoyed in verse 10. Oh. Came to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Their reaction was to worship. Physically, a reaction to get down on their knees, even to get down on their faces and bow down before him. This is a recognition of royalty, of kingship of Jesus. It may even be crossing over into this like worship of him as divine. They knew something big was happening. They heard all the prophecies. They saw the star. It was moving. And they had this sense that this child is chosen. This child is special. This child is set apart beyond all other kings because of what's happening right here. They bowed down and they worshiped him. And then they gave him gifts. Expensive gifts, gold, incense, myrrh. These are things that a poor Israelite family should have no business owning. It was too expensive for them. These were gifts fit for a king. Gold, the most precious commodity there is. The special spices and lotions and things for the incense and the myrrh. This is stuff they could never afford in 100 lifetimes. Given to them as a gift. Signaling that this child is worthy of worship and adoration. This is truly the stamp of God saying he is a king. They came to worship him. These kingmakers all this pomp and circumstance? What does it add up to? What is it all about? Why would God coordinate this? Well, the book of Matthew, out of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that tell the story of Jesus' life, Matthew has a particular aim throughout his gospel to show that Jesus is a king. You see the theme repeated many times throughout the book of Matthew. In fact, the first opening verses start talking about the genealogy of Jesus, that he was traced coming through the genealogy of Abraham, that he was, so this is a promised line where God was going to do something big through Abraham's offspring. Then you get to David, and he had the promise of having a son on his throne that would reign forever and ever, kind of a miraculous God-sized kind of king. This is the promise of the Messiah. And all the way you can see the genealogy traced down to Joseph and Mary, and then to Jesus Christ. This is Matthew's aim from the very beginning of the book. Then he tells the story how Jesus was to come to Mary and to Joseph, how he would appear in her womb, and immediately right into the story of the Magi. Kingmakers sent there to worship Christ, to put the stamp of God's identity of him as his promised one, as the Messiah who's come to earth. The whole aim of this was to say, well, since the world's not going to recognize him, since King Herod's not going to recognize him, since Caesar's not going to recognize him, since the Jewish chief priests aren't going to recognize him, I'm going to send these guys here and they will. Give him a proper royal recognition. It's an amazing thing that God did, and he set it up hundreds of years earlier. Wow. The real payoff question is this. Do you recognize Jesus as the king? Is he king in your life? King over all of what you do, all of what you have, all of what you are? Do you see him as king over this country, of this world, of all time? Is he really the one who's overseeing everything from creation all the way to the end? Is he really the one who's working out his plan of salvation? Do you really trust in him? Or are you resisting him? Do you seek him the way that the wise men did? That they traveled 800 miles, months and months out of their life, all the cost and the expense to do what they did for this one child? To get a glimpse of his face? Are you seeking Christ like that? Think about your last week. How much have you sought Christ? How much have you worshiped him? Prayed? Been in awe and wonder of him? Trusted him for the needs in your life? Trusted him for the guilt of your sin? Obeyed him for the things that he asks of you to do? Is he really your king? Think of the reaction of the Magi when they bowed down and worshiped him. Will you bow down? Will you worship him? Will you bring gifts to him that are costly? Well, you don't have gold and incense and myrrh, and we're not even asked to bring that specifically to him. What do you have to give him? More than even all the resources in your life, which that's included too. What you and I have to give him is ourselves. Your heart, your will, your desires, your attention, your trust. Do you give yourself to Jesus? Jesus is the King. He's the king of all kings. He's God who's come to earth. He's the one who was sent to walk in our shoes, to be our perfect representative before God, as the one who would save us. He is our light. He is our life. He is Emmanuel. He's our defender. He's our hope. He's our joy. He's our righteousness. He is all of these things for us. And we are told to give our lives to him in worship. Romans 12:1 says this, therefore, in view of God's mercy, all that he has done for you, all that he is for you, offer yourselves as living sacrifices. And this is your spiritual act of worship. Do you want to worship the king? Do you want to honor the king? Then come and bring your very life before him and offer yourself to him. All that you are, all of you, your present, your past, your future, all of your hopes, all of your hurts, all of your heartaches, all of your dreams, all that you have, give it to him. A living sacrifice. You no longer live for yourself and for your own reasons. You live for him. That is the only gift worthy of this king. We've created some time here at the end of our service as a response. Here we are just 6 days before Christmas. What better thing can we do but to worship Christ the Lord? I invite the worship team to come. And I want to give you a challenge. There's a difference between singing and worship. They can go hand in hand. But we can sing a lot without ever worshiping. We can sing a tune on the radio. We can kind of hum something in our minds. We could sing in the shower. You can sing at church and not worship, folks. Happens every week. A lot of people come and they don't even think of how is this worship to the Lord. I want to challenge you to make this a time of adoration, of honor, of recognition of the royal position of Christ over yourself and over our world. To proclaim him as the Savior, the one true Savior of the world. The King of your life. And at some point as we're singing, I want to challenge you to envision that you have made a long journey and you finally reached this king and you get a glimpse of his face. And what would you do? How would you react if you get to see the king of all the ages? What will you give him of your worship? What will you give him of your life? Imagine you have a gift in your hands and you're giving it to him. And that gift is yourself. Picture that. Worship him. As we go through this time, I invite you to have the freedom to do what you need to do to worship him. If you want to stand, if you want to sit, if you want to kneel, if you want to bow, if you want to have hands out before him like the gift, if you want to have hands up like you're exalting him, lifting him high, let's worship and honor Christ. That's what Christmas is about in our response. It's giving glory and honor to him.